The Sunstone Foundation presents I Married a Mormon and Live to Tell This Tale. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Oops, I've curled my speech up here. My name is David Pankhurst. My wife's Janet Cornwall. She's in the back of the room there. We have a much easier time than any of the other panelists do because I am not... You can't hear me. Sorry, I'm not used to these things. Closer. Okay. Real close. How's that? Okay. We have a much easier time than the people on this panel because I'm not religious in any way. I don't believe in God. I don't entertain any kind of philosophical beliefs other than... Still can't hear me. Other than logic and courtesy... And the Golden Rule is probably the closest thing to a philosophy that I have. I believe you can pretty much reduce your life down to the Golden Rule and get along just fine. And that gives us a very easy life together. We don't have a problem of conflicting religions. We don't have a problem of where are our children going to go. Our children are going to be Mormons if they want to be. That's fine with me. I don't have any problem with that. But there's no conflict. So I've come here today to tell you mostly... how you can get along better with the secular world. I've enjoyed my relationship with my wife, and it's been a great learning experience, and I've enjoyed my 5 months that I've lived in Salt Lake. It's been the nicest place I've ever lived. It's clean. It's safe. The majority of people seem to work hard. It's a great place, and you've got a lot of good things going for you. But I do believe you need to learn how to get along with people a little better, and not have so many cases of misplaced alienation. So, with that in mind, it's the second time my family's been contacted to speak on this subject, which tells me that it's a fairly rare and unusual marriage that we have. I think we should all reflect on why that's so. Group animosities are things that we should actively explore. We must all move and work to reduce them in every instance. I didn't come here, and you didn't invite me, because this is a no-problem, it's great kind of situation. But before I give you a piece of my mind, I'd like to tell you some of the predicted problems that haven't occurred. First of all, I found out that Mormons do have sex. And judging from the number of children, it's quite well. I don't have to drive my wife everywhere. I was told that bicycles were a requirement by Joseph Smith. My mother was really upset when she found out that I was marrying a Mormon. She thought that Janet would be the first, and to be more wise. And that didn't come to be either. I found out that Mormons are Christians. My father says National Geographic says they're not, and we're still battling that. But we're making headway. And Janet did not marry me for the sole purpose of converting me. And the Mormon women in general do not go out and marry heathen men, convert them, and leave them and go find another one, which is something I was also told. Draw an analogy. A lot of people today would like to see us change the Constitution and make flag burning illegal. That's a new hoot and holler right now. And it seems to be an American approach of choice to almost everything. We legislate, we build jails, we build walls. We know our rights, and we don't know our manners. Americans have forgotten that things are simply rude sometimes. And there is a responsibility that we each have to respect each other's sensibilities. We've all been faced with a determined host. His invitation is firstly taken, pending later discussion with one's spouse. Well, he hands you the phone. And you say, she's out. He says, try anyway. He changes subjects. He returns to it. You remember a previous engagement. And it goes on, ad nauseum. And finally, you let the smile drop from your face, and you alter your tone of voice, and you say, I'm quite positive that I'm busy. And what's happened? An acquaintance whose company you probably enjoy to some extent has forced an awkward and embarrassing situation. and you're going to avoid that person for a while, and you're never going to feel as comfortable in that person's company, or at least not for a while. Last week, after sacrament meeting, the bishop spoke with my wife. One of the things he asked her was why I was so distant and difficult to talk to. I've learned that there are precisely 7 Mormons on whom I can count to respect my non-Mormonism, and they're my in-laws. I let my guard down a couple months ago with a friend that I'd made here at school, and everything was going fine. I just completely forgot that there was any problem. I treated him like an in-law. And all of a sudden, one day, he started asking me about my being a Mormon, and I said I wasn't, and they hadn't really caught on. I have this little trick. When I go to sacrament meeting, I call everybody brother and sister, and I carry Jan's books, and it works great. Nobody knows. Well, he figured it out, and 2 days later, priesthood's on the phone, and they want to come over, and want to talk with me, and I slid out of that one. Next thing I know, the missionaries had contacted Janet, and they wanted to talk to Janet, which is fine. You know, home teachers come and talk to Janet, and the other one, name escapes me, they come over regularly, and it's fine, no problem. Oh, the day they were supposed to come, they call up on the phone to make sure I was going to be home. And they got there. And I'll bet you $100 they have video with them. I've seen the video. And I didn't want to see it again, and I told them so. But what an awkward and sad situation. I got along really well with these people. Perfectly happy with these people. And all of a sudden, they force it. Bang. And they won't take no for an answer. I have to tell them. Another thing. Every Mormon church has the words, "Visitors welcome," emblazoned on the side of the building. You can see it from the road. Let me tell you about how I was welcomed the day my eldest son was blessed. My mother and father-in-law had traveled from here to Richmond, Virginia, where my wife and I lived. He administered the blessing, being a high priest. Everything was going just fine, and then everybody sat down, and it was time for the normal meeting. And it was Testament Day, which is something I've since learned to avoid. Every time I go to Testament Day, I'm in trouble. And I went there, and the message for thought that day was delivered by a young lady, and she proceeded to tell a sad and very noble story of how she had given her fiancé an ultimatum: "You join the church or I'm going to leave you." And the prospective groom didn't want to join the church. He wasn't a Mormon, he wasn't going to be a liar, and he told her so, and she left him, and she went on a mission. And she wept and concluded with one of the requisite words that one ends a testimony with, and everyone intoned amen, which to me means what it means in Hebrew, which is "let it be so," which is an agreement. And, I didn't really feel very welcome being a non-Mormon, married to a Mormon in that particular position that day. The first time I came to Salt Lake was to be introduced to the Cornwalls prior to this. I'd never met them before. My wife and I came up for 2 days. We were both in the Army. We drove here from Monterey. There was so much snow on the ground, we had to go through Las Vegas, and we were dead tired, and we got here, but we're going to go to church. Again, it was a Testament meeting, and the speaker got up, and he went on and on about the dreadful experience he's had in the world. And I didn't understand what he was talking about. I understood the words, but what was the world doing to him? This conspiracy. And it seemed to be reaching out, this firmament, and affecting this poor fellow. And suddenly, about the third or the fourth speaker that had gotten up to talk about the evils of the world, I began to realize that it was me. And everybody else liked me. That they were talking about. And that began my interest in Mormon use of colloquialisms. And I think that the words a person chooses that are not the normal words betray his feelings about what he's talking about. And I've learned since that I'm the world, and I learned that I used to live in the mission field. My wife talked for ages about being on island. I had no idea that Taiwan had been renamed. But it had. And then I learned that you all were the saints. And I couldn't help noticing a difference between these choices in the groups of the words, and that the ones describing me were inanimate. And the ones describing y'all were saint. And I thought about, what is a saint? I'm not a Catholic, but saints are people that are better than other people. I think that's a fairly clear distinction there. Most saints, you don't get to be a saint for being naughty anyway. And I began to sort of resent it. You know, I'm a man, I'm an American, I'm a student, I'm a lot of things. I'm a Gentile. I'm not the world. I am human. I'm animate. And I'm a Gentile, but it's because I'm not Jewish. I have a home, and my people have given it a name. And you can find it in books that way, but not the mission field. I'm glad that you all are happy, and I don't deny you the use of your colloquialism, but if you're going to call yourself saints, you're going to have to redefine that word too, in some instances, if you're going to make everyone fit in the hereafter. I think we all are people. We all have our fallibilities. We all have our positive and our negative aspects. We need to take respect for those things. Finally, along the same lines as proselytizing, I'd like to say that from the world's point of view, you need to pull back a little. My wife and I have made friends with Jim and Connie Robertson. They, like us, are new here, moved here from Tennessee. And they're really considering making Utah their home for the same reasons that I discussed earlier. It's a wonderful place. It's a wonderful culture. Jim is really upset, though, because he wants his kid to be a Boy Scout. He doesn't want his kid to be a Mormon Boy Scout, just a Boy Scout. Other things that tend to step on people's toes are being told you got to drink 3-2 beer. You know, it's just annoying. You know, Budweiser, they charge just as much for Budweiser in Utah as they do in Virginia. I just get more water in it. And I went out, when I first got here, I went down to Trolley Square, and we sat down in a little cobblestone area, and I tried to order a gin and tonic. Well, they told me I had to have a sandwich. I just had dinner. I didn't want a sandwich. But I needed to have a sandwich before I could have my gin and tonic. At the same time, that gin and tonic was going to contain 1.7 ounces of liquor by law in this state. I used to tend bar in Virginia. I did it my entire way through college. And if I poured a 1.7 ounce drink, my manager would have fired me. You never give anybody more than an ounce and a quarter. But by law here, you restrict our drinking and force us to drink more. Well, I hope that you'll keep in mind that the barrage of criticism I've heaped on you is meant to be constructive. If I didn't think this is the nicest place I've ever been, thanks in large part to you, I wouldn't have spent the time coming for you. I appreciate it, and thank you.
How is this? Okay. While I'm not a public speaker, I enthusiastically accepted Karen's invitation to share with you my experience being a, quote, cultural Jew married to a cultural Mormon. Of my LDS friends, only the sunstone type were comfortable with the phrase cultural Mormon, but that's for another seminar. Ken and I have been married almost 23 years, and while some of you might think I sound as if I left New York, New Jersey area yesterday, I have lived here since 1971. For 9 months when we were first married, before that also. Ken, working in New York City, was the first Latter-day Saint I had ever met. I thought the group was similar to the Amish. This is despite the fact that I was a graduate of an academically challenging university and had been to Europe several times and to Israel. It was 1966. I don't think that would be true today. I think now that the LDS Church has a large building in New York City, many more people are aware of the religion. I liked Ken before I fell in love with him, though I confess we knew each other only 3 weeks before we knew we'd marry. I never thought I'd marry out of my religion. Ken recalls being surprised that my parents were opposed. He thought only Mormons were unhappy when their children married out of their religion. My parents were so unhappy, they secretly hired a private detective in the hope of finding something bad about Ken or his family that they could use to dissuade me. You cannot imagine how out of character this was for my parents, but they were desperate. Nothing was discovered, of course. Orthodox Jews go into mourning when a child marries a non-Jew, the same as when someone close dies. My parents considered doing this, but decided not to. I was always close to my dad, yet he didn't speak to me for 2 years after the marriage. My mom was more practical, perhaps. She came to our marriage ceremony in a judge's chambers, but we asked her not to attend the party we threw for herself because she was not in a celebrating frame of mind. Only one intermarried aunt and uncle came. We received no gifts from my close-knit family, though my 21-year-old brother was secretly supportive. Later, my parents grew to love and appreciate Ken and his family, but that was way later. Ken's divorced mom and I met several months before the marriage, and we immediately liked each other. While she is a very religious LDS person, she told Kenneth she understood that he loved me, and she became supportive of our marriage. I assume that she has hoped I'd convert, but she has never actively pursued this. After our honeymoon, she hosted a reception, which was my introduction to meeting practicing Mormons. I was very touched when a man in his late 70s, a former bishop, told me, "You're marrying for the best reason, love." We moved back to New York City for Ken to earn his Master's of Social Work degree. We can't recall anyone there discussing religion. When people here asked me if I were, quotes, a member, I remember sarcastically telling Ken I wanted to reply, "No, I'm not a joiner." This hasn't occurred in years, thank goodness. When I first spoke with Karen, I explained that I might not even qualify as a Jewish spouse for this panel's purpose because I attend synagogue services only when friends' children are being bar or bat mitzvahed, a ceremony for 13-year-olds. I also attend Holocaust memorial services and Israel independence celebrations. Two, Ken and I agreed our children would be reared with the best moral and ethical code we could provide, but in no formal religion. I was not comfortable having the children Mormon, and Ken was not having it comfortable being the outsider. By the way, our sons, who are now 16 and 13, tend to have friends of several religions who practice in varying degrees. They have not been interested in any religious service they have attended and feel really comfortable being of no religion. I do acknowledge that I enthusiastically identify as Jewish, and I'm very proud of my heritage, as Ken is of his. However, while I lived in New York City and when we first moved here, I never sought out any Jewish organizations. I always contributed financially to Israel, however. Maybe I should digress and observe that Ken supports, or at least has never minded, my check writing to charitable causes, whether they are for Jewish but non-religious organizations, to fight poverty, for medical research, to support the arts, etc. I think the LDS practice of tithing is wonderful, and that the contribution and volunteer ethic is especially strong in both of our cultures. This might also explain why Ken has been so tolerant of the many hours I have given to many causes, especially National Council of Jewish Women here in Salt Lake City, which again is not religious, it's cultural, and it does a lot for children across the United States, not just Jewish children, and a lot of other fairly liberal social causes. I must share, however, that when I have solicited for the Cancer Society and the Heart Association, I have felt that some LDS people think that because they tithe, they don't need to contribute to other causes. I'd like them to consider themselves part of the whole, not just the LDS community. As I've knocked on doors and volunteered many hours, so has my dear religious LDS mother-in-law, and so did my very Jewish mother until her death. It feels good to recognize this. I grew up in a very Catholic community. Because education was not a priority in this town, my parents sent me to a small Hebrew-English school through the eighth grade. I received a wonderful education, but I felt humiliated being seen leaving for school when the neighbor kids were on their Christmas and Easter vacation breaks. People who didn't know my dad was Jewish would often make anti-Jewish statements to him. He never confronted them, but would come home and tell us. Maybe as a result of this, I can accept certain political decisions the majority makes for Utah. Still, I'm offended when public prayers are made, quotes, in the name of Jesus Christ, end of quotes. Ken understands this and has explained that to Mormons, it's not a prayer if it's not said this way. I have explained this to Jewish and Catholic friends here who have bristled as I have. Ken was the first in his family, and I the first in mine, to receive a college degree, and our families were especially proud. Our cultures share a love of words, books, and knowledge. When I asked a friend, born Jewish but not practicing, what he thought made our culture unique, he thought for a while and he said, "We have more books per capita in our homes. The only other comparable group are the Boston Brahmins, and they have more money and have been educated for more generations." I'll add that the Sunstone members I know love books, too. We all say we love children. Jewish people feel they're demonstrating this when they choose to have two or three. The idea is quality. Give them all the enrichment one can afford and spend as much time as possible nurturing. Ken shares these views, and he is from a family of four children. We waited 6 years and had a home and a nest egg before our first child was born. Both of us feel that people with many children in public school should pay more in taxes toward the children's education. We also think alike politically, though Ken is less comfortable than I am with total availability of choice regarding abortion. That directly relates to his culture. Conservative people here see me as, quotes, a spunky woman, end of quotes, the opposite of passive. Yet Ken's paternal grandmother, reared in the home of a patriarch, was unconventional enough to be a successful door-to-door salesperson in the 30s while pursuing her love of singing opera and rearing five children. My maternal grandmother and mother were not passive either. My mother-in-law is more passive. I have taught my own brand of assertion to a number of friends, mostly of LDS background, as the Jewish ones haven't shown a need. The friends of LDS background have been eager students. I have helped them handle problems with school administrators, with husbands' divorce lawyers, etc. Ken's reaction to my lack of passive acceptance of what I feel is unjust ranges from cheering me on to mild amusement to being horrified. During the ERA era, he received a letter from church authorities lamenting the lack of involvement of some Mormon wives in Relief Society and instructing him to tell me to get involved. It isn't in our relationship to tell each other what to do, and to be honest, I had to read the letter twice. I couldn't believe it. It is so foreign to my culture. If I were an ultra-Orthodox Jew, this dictum would be expected. I confessed I was most outrageous when four members of the bishopric arrived unannounced one evening as we were unpacking in our new home. The honest truth is, it was without malice that I said, "I hope you didn't come to talk about religion." That really just popped out of my mouth. But the bishop didn't miss a beat and replied, "No, we just want to meet our new neighbors." And Ken and I and the four men had an enjoyable chat. They didn't return, however. I'm here to share my perspective with you, and my Jewish friends see me as one who knows more about your religion and culture than they do. Am I right in counseling them to be honest with missionaries and other proselytizing people, as opposed to simply being gracious but feeling inwardly resentful? Perhaps we can discuss this afterward. You should be aware that the Jewish religion not only does not encourage proselytizing, it makes it difficult for people who seek to convert. Regarding alcohol, you might know that wine is used in the practice of the Jewish religion, and that Jewish people have traditionally had a low alcoholism rate, although this is changing in the less practicing group in this generation. My parents would always offer guests one drink, and at weddings there was always an open bar. I never saw anyone drunk, and I drink very little. However, until he came to New York City, Ken was never at a party with alcohol where he didn't see drunken behavior. Two, and in fact I should mention that at friends' weddings in New York, he was amazed to see that no one got drunk. Two, practicing LDS friends would ask him how come he wasn't wild, since if he didn't have the constraints of his religion, there was nothing to hold him back. The answer is he isn't a basically wild person. Regarding smoking, I'm lucky that it was anathema in his culture, because when I met him, I stopped smoking my one cigarette a day. In ending, I want you to know that the only rabbi in Utah could not think of one synagogue-attending Jewish person married to a practicing LDS person. Hence, you're hearing me. When I asked a close friend, who is president of the women's group of the synagogue, if she thought I qualified to offer this presentation, she replied, "Wilma, you're the most Jewish person I know. You figure it." Thank you.
Can you hear me? All right. I was invited to speak here about 24 hours ago, so I'm going to be scrambling to put things together as I'm standing here. I realized in being invited to this, where LDS and non-LDS are married, that somehow I flash back on the Donahue show this week where I had seen black and white couples married, and that they were so unique that they were up front and talking about the relationship. So I thought, gee, this is really unusual. When I talk about being married to Nancy, I describe that my decision to marry her was the best decision I've ever made in my life. And I'm the happiest I have ever been. And 50% of that is her, and 50% of that is me. I almost scratch my head a little bit to be on a panel like this, because it doesn't seem that it has to be that unusual that different people marry from different religions. To me, as a Presbyterian minister, I do weddings all the time where, for me, that is the norm. But I understand that that's a little unique here. So I want to talk about what seems to me makes a marriage work. Because that seems to me the problem, not whether you're LDS or non-LDS or what your religions are, but making a marriage work. As a counselor and a therapist, what I see is that folks don't seem to have a real big clue about how to do that. So I want to share with you some of the ideas that I've come up with to make what I think makes a marriage work, makes it vital, makes it meaningful, regardless of whether you're in the same faith or not. When I married, I didn't choose to marry a Mormon. When I married, I chose to marry Nancy. And of all the things that she happens to be, one of them is the fact that she is a Mormon. She didn't plan to marry a Presbyterian, let alone a Presbyterian minister. And I can remember that when we first started dating, she was a little hesitant as to whether she should kiss me or not, because, gee, it would be like kissing a priest. And so she soon came to terms with that. for me, just getting married was the major decision. We dated for about 3 years. A lot of ups and downs. There were times where Nancy would say, is this relationship going somewhere? Is this going to be something permanent? Many times I answered no. That as best I could see, and actually one of the few times in my life I was absolutely honest with her, I didn't fudge at all. That's how it seemed to me. And the problem wasn't our faith, the problem was the way in which we functioned together. And that I thought I had an image of how I wanted things to be, and it wasn't that way yet. I can even remember at one point we broke up near the end of our dating, and I was so empty and lacking that I got together again with her and said, I wanted some more time, that I recognized that there was something here that was very important to me, and I wanted more time. So we gave ourselves 6 months, and we decided that by Labor Day, I had to decide yes or no. And so soon it was Labor Day weekend, and we were headed to Flaming Gorge, and Nancy reminded me that sometime during this weekend, I had to make up my mind. And I started saying, well, backpedaling a little bit, I haven't talked about all the things I need to talk about. And she said, maybe so, but you've had the time, and you just need to decide, either way. And when I left that weekend for Flaming Gorge, I didn't know. And the one thing I found myself doing was praying. Not praying in a desperate sense, but simply holding up that I had done a lot of work in this relationship, there was a lot of good that was here, but I needed to know, and I needed a sign that I had done all the work I could do, but I needed to, this is a part of me, this is how I know things, I need a sign. And I knew. When I got married, my family was not surprised that I was marrying a Mormon. They were just surprised that I was getting married. I was 38 years old and never been married before. When I listened to the panelists yesterday, the LDS folks, I must admit I felt very deeply sad that somehow there was so much questioning. There was so much distancing when it seems to me if that kind of decision is made, it should be honored. Today's divorce rate is 50%. I do counseling in Ogden, and I know the divorce rate in Ogden is 50% above the national average. It's sort of like the story of the pilot who's flying along at 30,000 feet and all of a sudden, he comes over the intercom and he says, ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention? I have an announcement. I have some good news and I have some bad news. The bad news is that we're lost. The good news is that we're gaining speed. And in some ways like this, the religious issue is so secondary to me to the primary issue about how do you get along with people in life? How do you make a marriage work? How do you love your children? How do you do that? I don't know. That's why this feels a little awkward to me, because my orientation is not so much Presbyterian versus Mormon, Catholic, or whatever. When I do premarital counseling with a couple, their faith is down the road in priority for me. One of the first things that I tell a couple is, and this is a way of kind of like, you know, the stories where you hit the bull in the head to get his attention, is I say to couples that I don't think marriage means anything. There are no traditions anymore. And if there are, there isn't enough of a society or community to reinforce those. So I think marriage as a given doesn't mean anything. The only thing marriage can mean is what two people look to each other and say to each other, this relationship will mean. These will be the terms of this relationship. That is what religion is what marriage will mean. I don't ask you to buy what I'm going to tell you here, but I'd like you to think about it. It's sort of like going for a job interview. If you go for a job interview, you ask a lot of questions. You find out what are your responsibilities. You find out about your compensation. What are the benefits? You get all of this thing very specific, and you get it in writing before you would ever accept that job. What's amazing to me is that there seems to be almost no comparison between a marriage and finding a job. I think there's a great deal to compare. I see couples on the other side of marriage who come to me because it's not working, and they say things like, well, I thought they saw things the same way. I thought what I was doing was making them happy. It's sort of like they're guessing. They don't really know. But I just thought. I think a lot of it needs to be specified. In fact, I go so far as to say to a couple that the only thing that exists in your relationship is what one of you says you want, the other person says, yes, I'll do that, and they agree upon it as specifically as possible. Otherwise, it doesn't exist. And even then, it only enhances the possibility that it'll happen. The second thing that I see about relationships is that there seems to be a tremendous lack of understanding of how to fight fairly. That the couples who are getting married come with their glow, and they really want this relationship to work, and they yet are very fearful, and enter it on a good level. I invite them to a different level. I invite them to establish some ground rules of fighting, because it's going to be at that point that whatever commitment means will have to come into play. It does not have to come into play so much when things are really good, because it's just there. But it's when the rub comes. And how do you process that? What will you do with that? And for most of us, we learned what we do with that from our parents. And again, looking at statistics, statistics are not good in terms of how to deal with that. This business of how to resolve conflict. First of all, what I'm wanting to present, first of all, I think there's some psychological dimensions and there's spiritual dimensions of what I think makes my relationship work with Nancy. It's something that I believe in. And that's what I'm trying to elucidate here a little bit, is why I think our marriage works. It's been 3.5 years. Nancy and I, when people ask how are things going, in fact, I even had my best man here from our wedding 2 weeks ago, and he's wanting to catch up with me and find out, you know, well, really, how are things going? And people are surprised when I continue to say, almost like an after-wedding feeling, that things are so good. Things continue to get better. So that's what I'm wanting to describe to you, what I think in our relationship contributes to that. One of the things is we have it clear about how we will resolve conflict. First of all, that conflict is okay. For us, it's a given. For us, one of the things is that it's okay to bring up problems. When Nancy's unhappy, I want to know about it. I don't want her to hold back on it. I want her to give me all of it. I will be there to listen to it. I will not leave. I don't want to be attacked, but I'm willing to hear it. When there's a problem, I'm going to look for a solution that's a win-win solution. Most of the couples I meet don't even know what that concept is about. At best, they know win-lose, or maybe win-lose, compromise. But most of them have not conceived of the possibility that both people could get what they want. They haven't thought long enough and worked together to find a win-win solution. I remember one time when we were dating, this business of setting boundaries in a relationship, Nancy was not sure whether I was going to be, even in a dating situation, faithful to her, whether I might not have some affection for someone else or become sexually involved with someone else. So I remember one time, she got out a pad of paper and she wrote down, "I will not become involved with another person affectionately, sexually, and if I do, I will tell the other." And she wanted to know that. This is like a contract. And I said, "Yes, I'll do that. Will you do that?" She said, "Yes." It then became in place in our relationship. It didn't exist before then, but it became in place. Even though Nancy and I come from very different traditions, and Nancy is a very active, faithful, believing Mormon, and I'm a very active, believing Presbyterian, there are so many things in common that we have that they are so much greater than the differences. Common values, common ways of processing things. We look for mutual decisions. We try to be fair with each other. Let me give you a little bit about what I see as a theological or spiritual position that I think we have in common, even though we come from such different traditions. One of the things the Presbyterian Church has been known for is being what I call a peacemaking church. It's become very active in the anti-nuclear movement. Peacemaking, it seems to me, is not a unique calling of any particular denomination. It is the calling of all those who are faithful, that it is only those who God calls and those who want to respond. That is their task. This was true in the Exodus, that out of their gratitude for God's freeing them, they wanted to be his people. And God's call in being his people was to live their life like God was relating to them. That was what they had to choose. So that they had to be fair, they had to show justice, they had to show mercy. And they were going to do this not to gain privilege, not to be gain wealth, not to look better in the community, but simply to be faithful to their God. Look at Jesus' life. It's a very costly thing to do. One other theological concept is not just peacemaking, but an inner peace. Now, as I was growing up, I used to think that inner peace had to do with the fact that I'm kind of an uptight person. That inner peace had to do with times where I would relax and get calm. And in those moments, I would feel my body warm up. At times, I would even get a vision that everything here belonged, and even me. When I became involved in the peace movement and became active as an advocate for, like, the planet, for all people, I became aware of another dimension of an inner peace. And it didn't come to me like calm. It came to me like integrity. It came to me like power, like knowing what I was for and what I was against. And what I began to realize is that that kind of inner peace is only the byproduct of doing the peacemaking. I hope I'm not losing you. Maybe I am. This stuff is very important to me, and I would like to get it across in a way that, you know, you're awake and it makes sense and all, but maybe I'm not doing that. One other faith point of view to me that again illuminates how I think Nancy and I relate to each other and the way in which we look at things that is in common, even though our faiths are very different. When I was campus minister at the university, I would see students who were working real hard to get real good in their classes because they could get that big job. And I would tell them, you know, it's really neat that you're here, but it's not really that important how well you do. It's not really that important whether you get straight A's. Or whether you pass that test, it's great if you do, it's not that important ultimately. It's not that important that you get an insight while you're here. The only thing that's ultimately important while you're here at the University of Utah is that somehow the insights you get become you. That you embody those insights. That's all that matters, ultimately. And that's, I think, part of what Nancy and I believe, is that the Spirit is attempting to grow us to become those insights. It's what we talk about in terms of the incarnation. The Spirit became flesh. It's not how much what you know. How much of it is who you are? That idea of character is one of the things that I know I have in common with the LDS community. It's one of the things that critiques me. It critiques the Presbyterian Church, and it critiques the LDS Church. I don't want Nancy to be a Presbyterian. I like that she's different. I like that her faith makes sense to her, enlivens her, and I want her to grow in that. I don't want her to be a Presbyterian. I'm not interested in being Mormon. I am interested in how the two of us can enrich each other. Let me give you one example, and I'll stop on this. We were downtown at a restaurant here in Salt Lake, and we sat down, and just as we sat down, a man in the next table jumped up from his table, ran out of the restaurant with the waitress running after him. Well, I didn't know what was going on, and all of a sudden I found myself running too to get this guy. You know, and quickly I was figuring out, well, this guy didn't pay for his meal. So by the time we got outside, he was around the corner. And I came back thinking, gee, you know, wish I could have grabbed this guy. So, you know, this waitress is kind of out and everything. And my wife waited till the waitress came back, and she said to her, did he pay for his meal? And she said, no, he just took off. He'd only had coffee, actually. And Nancy said, we'll be glad to pay for his coffee. And then she said, if we had known that he was hungry or without, we would have been glad to buy him a meal. It's amazing how judged I felt at that point, or how much out of step I was, that her point of view was so much more gracious than mine, so much more in Christ's vision than mine, that I need her, and I need her to be the way she is.
Well, I wish I were a better extemporaneous speaker, because each of the panel members have brought a flood of ideas to me that I could completely restructure my talk. But I'm not, and so I'm not a good extemporaneous speaker, and so I'm going to stick with my prepared text. Let me start this by saying that I didn't pick the title of this panel. I'm not yet sure that I have survived the experience of living with a Mormon. But after more than 14 years of close association with Mormons, I count them among my strongest friends and my dearest loved ones, and I would certainly hope that for these individuals, nothing I would say today would be offensive. But I am here to tell you about the experiences that I have had as an NM married to an RM. And for my panelists, let me interpret that if you have never looked at the ward directory of your ward, you might, because you will find that you are listed there as an NM. And of course, an RM is a returned missionary. Steve and I have been married for 12 years, 1 month, and 24 days. We're both associate professors of chemistry, and yes, we do get teased a lot about the chemistry being right between us. We've lived both in Utah and out of Utah. For the first 5 years of our marriage, we were graduate students in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and postdoctoral students in Manhattan while Steve was at Columbia. We then moved to Utah, where we have been on the faculty at Brigham Young University for 7 years, and until very recently, we just have returned from Utah after an 8-month stay in Cambridge, where we were both on sabbatical leave at MIT. Steve and I are an unusual couple in many respects. Joint careers, unusual, particularly with respect to this topic today, in terms of our religious activity. Until having met Wendy this morning, I can tell you that in 12 years, actually 14 years of knowing, 15 years of knowing Steve, I had never met another couple in which both parties were active in their respective religions. Now, as a Catholic, at the time Steve and I were married, the ecumenizing aspects of Vatican II were in somewhat force, and so the idea of a non-Catholic marrying a Catholic was not particularly unique. But the considerably fewer marriages between a Mormon and a non-Mormon that I'm aware of have generally involved an inactive Mormon. And frankly, I hope that Steve doesn't get any more active than he already is. He currently serves as the executive secretary of his ward, and since we've been married, he's been Sunday school president, elders quorum counselor and president, and first and second counselors and bishoprics, and this is just since we've been married. Before I knew him, he served 2 years in the Switzerland Zurich mission. I've always been an active Catholic, and yet I think the experience of being a minority in Utah has made me a more committed one, and for that I am deeply grateful to you all. A product of Catholic schools, grade school, high school, and undergraduate college, I have taught catechism classes, I serve in my parish as a Eucharistic minister and a lector, and I have worked in campus ministry with the 200 or so Catholic students who attend BYU. Because religion was important to the two of us, family and friends were surprised when we announced our plans to marry. Ours was an atypical courtship by Utah standards. We dated for 3 years, not the 3 weeks I find at BYU. Two of them via long-distance phone calls until we were together at the same graduate school. After a year of a more normal courtship, that is, we were living in the same city. One cannot call courtship during graduate school normal. We got married. Most of the reason that we waited so long was to be sure that we really knew what would be involved in trying to bring two strong religious views to a marriage without tearing it apart. Even after 3 years, we were pretty naive. There were some who felt the need to talk us out of our plans, and let me just give you one amusing anecdote from my side of the family. An aunt woke my father up with a frantic phone call one morning at 6 o'clock. She told him that I didn't know what I was getting into and he had to do something to stop this marriage. It turned out that she had just seen an interview with Chief Joseph, a polygamist, on a morning news program. My father told her that Steve was not a polygamist and please to go back to bed. Other incidents were more painful. They involved dear friends and I won't recount them here. However, it is a sadness to me that most of my Catholic friends, particularly those in the East, but also some here in Utah, have never had the chance to know Steve, and therefore to get beyond the stumbling block, the label Mormon, has been for them. On his part, Steve received lectures from a home teacher who, in many months of visiting his family, never bothered to even learn the names of the children or to inquire about the health of his father, but yet nonetheless felt called upon to chide him for his weak testimony in marrying outside the temple. And like Wendy, I too have received the sense that our marriage is perceived by many to be a flawed one, and I'm sorry for Steve that in some ways I have made him a less acceptable person in the eyes of many of his church members. But fortunately, we both had wise parents who counseled us about the difficulties we might face, but supported us in our decision then and to this day. Can you hear me if I get away from this microphone? I really don't like the popping peas. Not until I moved to Utah did I fully realize just how unusual Steve's family had been in their acceptance and their love for me. Shortly after my arrival, I met with a professional colleague at the University of Utah who knew my in-laws. During lunch, completely out of the blue, he commented to me that my mother and father-in-law must have been terribly disappointed when Steve married me. As I choked on my fish, I mumbled out some kind of a reply that in my part of the country, it was the non-Catholic who was expected to convert. But it was thus that I was initiated into the stigma that is associated with one's marrying outside the LDS Church. I will be forever grateful for Steve's family, for the love with which they welcomed me from the very beginning. They continue to support me both as loving, supporting, and non-interfering grandparents of our daughter and in my Catholic activities. Their attendance at Easter Vigil services and at Christmas Eve Mass when I serve as a lector helps to ease the pain of being so far away from my own parents at these special times. Our wedding took place during a Catholic Mass in the chapel where I was an undergraduate, but I wanted to make sure that Steve's family felt involved in things as well, and his father gave us a blessing in the grotto the night before the wedding. His Mormon bishop was to have attended and participated in the Mass, but was prevented because of an illness in the family. His parents participated with mine in bringing the gifts to the offertory during the liturgy. And we included in the readings of the liturgy the beautiful words of Ruth to Naomi. Do not press me to leave you and to turn back from your company. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. For me, this reading was a proclamation that we would support each other by respecting and as much as possible participating in the religious life of the other. For one to have demanded conversion of the other would have required a denial of strongly held convictions. To have done so would have been against my understanding of the teaching and found in Matthew and Luke. Anyone who prefers father or mother to me is not worthy of me. Anyone who prefers son or daughter to me is not worthy of me. This does not mean that we do not still hope for, pray for, and occasionally invite conversion. It means that we entered into the marriage with the realization that, however much we might want a conversion to take place, our happiness could not be predicated upon the assumption that such an event would happen in the immediate future, if at all. Without a doubt, the most difficult aspect of our dual religious commitments concerns the rearing of our daughter Sarah, who is now 8 years old. Long before Sarah was born, during a preparation class required of all those wishing to be married in the Catholic Church, we pledged to each other that we would allow our children to be raised with education in both religions, that the choice of a final religious commitment would be theirs, and that it would never become a case of, if you become Catholic, you love Mommy more, or if you love Daddy best, you'll be Mormon. Of course, at the time we made this agreement, I had never lived in Utah, and I never expected that we would. I believe our plan is made more difficult because we live in Utah County, where she has no other examples of a, quote, good Mormon married to a, quote, good something else. Also, I did not realize how strong peer pressure is when every child in the neighborhood, all your classmates, and all your teachers are LDS. Nor did I realize how much at the forefront of everyday life religion is here. It is difficult for Sarah to enjoy her Catholic catechism classes. She dislikes being dragged away from her playtime with her friends, and she has no one in the neighborhood with whom to share these experiences. Those of you who have raised children outside of Utah, I'm sure, can relate to these issues. Having to live with our decision has been hard on Sarah and hard on me, much harder than I expected 12 years ago. Were I to remake any of the decisions of these 12 years, it might well be the one to come to Utah, despite the fact that I love my neighbors and my colleagues at BYU with all my heart. In probably the deepest heart of Mormondom, I have been accepted with love and generosity and warmth, and I especially don't want anything I say here to be misconstrued in that way. Perhaps surprisingly, the decision to accept the academic positions at BYU rather than industrial jobs in the Northeast was mine. While the director of the LDS Institute at the University of Michigan was telling the LDS students that the church had great need of them outside of Utah, he was telling us that we had a mission to fulfill there, and I believed him. From the time I married Steve, I have found myself in the position, very oftentimes an uncomfortable one, of playing mediator or translator between Mormons and the rest of the world. Perhaps that indeed is the mission President Nielsen had in mind. As I socialize with non-Mormon friends and listen to their latest Mormon horror story, I feel compelled to remind my friends that Mormons don't hold the patent on insensitivity and that the majority should not be condemned because of the few. On the other hand, I find that Mormons, particularly those who have served missions in Mexico or South America, have a very skewed idea of the American Catholic Church. Many do not realize that crucifixes and holy cards serve the same function in our homes that pictures of prophets and temples do in yours. A Mormon will talk about free agency. A Catholic speaks of the formation of a correct conscience. While Catholics agonize over church teachings concerning birth control or a celibate male priesthood, Mormons struggle with counsel on the proper role of women. I was a young child in pre-Vatican II Catholicism, and I'm sorry if that doesn't mean anything to you. I don't have the time to explain it. But the changes introduced by the Vatican Council when I was an adolescent proclaimed for me a church which was vibrant and relevant, while for others, these changes shook the very foundations of their belief. As a young adult, I have witnessed the strides made in ecumenical activities brought about by this council. As this ecumenical spirit grows within my church, and as I meet others like Steve, who are firmly and sincerely convinced of the truth of Jesus Christ of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I find that I am no longer comfortable with the idea of one true church which has the answers for all people. In the book, a simple but sweet book, Papa Married a Mormon, there is made the analogy that all religions are but windows in the same church letting in the light of God. I've stretched the analogy a bit further and wonder if perhaps religion, each religion, transmits some part of the truth as the different panes of a stained glass window transmit the colors of light. I am committed to my religion. I would not be happy as a Mormon. For my husband, the position, while reversed in direction, is equally strong. Can we both be right in our convictions? I am no theologian, and the answer with which I can live is more that of the pragmatic scientist than the abstract philosopher. Can it be that just as we are all given different gifts, different personalities, and different burdens to bear, we need different support systems to bear those burdens, different approaches which will allow us to achieve our place in the eternal plan of salvation? The liturgy of the Catholic Mass is for me deeply spiritual. The symbolism of the various actions, the ties to Old Testament traditions, the organizing structure of the liturgical calendar create for me an environment in which I can be uplifted and renewed. On the other hand, I have attended many sacrament meetings and Sunday school classes in which I have felt deeply moved emotionally, but I have rarely been touched on the spiritual or intellectual level that transcends emotion. I continue to struggle with the idea of how ultimately the Catholic and Mormon views of God, as well as those of others, might be resolved in another life. I firmly expect that this, along with quantum mechanical tunneling and the wave-particle duality of light, will be explained to me someday. Marriage and family life are never without problems, and certainly our religious differences have added a few unique ones to our life. But we have not allowed the differences to dominate our marriage, and I have a deeper understanding of God and a wider breadth of vision than I might ever have achieved married to the guy from Notre Dame I used to date. Thank you.
I want to thank you all for coming. I enjoyed hearing you very much. We really are out of time, but if they're willing to stay for maybe 10 minutes, those of you who would like to stay could stay and ask questions. And if you'd like to come up here and use the mic, that way we'll go on the tape better. Would that be all right? Okay. Are there any questions or comments? Can you come up? Okay. Marie Cornwall does. Is she here by any chance? All right. The question was whether there are any statistics kept on how many mixed marriages there are, interfaith marriages there are. I don't know what they are. I was told when I was looking for people for this that Marie Cornwall would know, but that their statistics were not easily given out. Is that true? Can anybody else comment? All right. Any other comments or questions? Can you come up?
Before you come up, I would like to ask how many people here are LDS? How many people here are in a mixed marriage? Thank you.
Basically, my question is really short. Yesterday, Richard Popp mentioned that he felt, at least, that Wendy was well accepted in the Mormon Church. I was just wondering what her position, her feelings were.
I can only answer this with an anecdote. I went to a Relief Society meeting, I believe it is. It's all women. Is that a Relief Society? Okay, I went to a Relief Society meeting with my sister-in-law, and somebody was talking about, said something from Isaiah. They speak with their mouths, but not with their hearts. And this woman said, of course, all the other churches believe this. I mean, all the other churches do this. That's how it is for every other person who's not Mormon. And I think I didn't say anything, but I certainly felt myself freaking out. And my sister-in-law leaned over to me, real quiet, and said, Lutherans, are you liturgical? And I said, yes. And she said, is that true? And I said, well, sometimes yes. And she said, but not all the time. And I said, oh no, certainly not. And she said, I didn't think so. And I felt God's love and the acceptance of Dick's family and also Dick's church, the members of his ward. I keep calling it a congregation, but the people of his ward have been very loving and welcoming to me.
I want to begin by just saying a great thank you to the panel and the time that we spent here in the room today. I think each of you have given a testimony. I'm using Mormon term, I'm Methodist. Each of you have given a witness this morning of what I would consider the most important work we all have to do in the world in our time, beginning to really appreciate one another individually, so that we can realize the hope of that the God who created all of us has for our well-being and our peace on earth. Thank you.
My name is Michelle Cornwall Kruger. I am Dave's sister-in-law. And I just want to share something, an important aspect of the impact that Dave has had in me and my family. As Wendy referred to, you know, the typical Protestant of a husband and a wife and three kids and a dog and a station wagon, I have everything but the dog. And that comes over from the neighbors. And so I have been feeling a little bit, well, is it all right to love your mate and have him be the same faith and enjoy that relationship and the enrichment of that faith? But as Dave has been in our family, and as my love and tenderness, not only for him but for others, regardless of what they believe, regardless of where they're at in their life,
I have felt my ward closed towards me. And this has been a very interesting phenomena that that I've experienced. And the broadness that has come from knowing Dave and allowing myself to be in many other situations like that more than make up for the closeness, the closing of my ward towards me. But I still have a testimony. I still am happy being a Mormon, and I feel the sadness that this openness can't be broadened. And I just wanted to comment on that.
Are there any other comments, questions?
I'm a unique person in that I was baptized a Lutheran, and my father is Jewish, and so I feel some camaraderie with some of the people here on the stand. To the Catholic lady, I was wondering, and I'm a converted to Mormonism, as I see it, Catholicism talks about the ultimate realities, and Mormonism talks about something less than that. Do you find that to be true also?
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by the ultimate realities, and I hope that my answer won't... again, I'm not a good extemporaneous speaker, but I remember reading something by Hugh Nibley, who is a fairly well... known Mormon writer, in which he made a statement, and I will paraphrase him poorly, I'm sure, that one of the things about Mormonism was that they were a very pragmatic religion, and they didn't have a lot of abstract theologians who got tied up in knots about various issues. And I realized that I think that probably was what didn't appeal to me, that he was correct, and that that was what I found not very appealing about Mormonism. I go to church to learn more than that I should be canning things, my vegetables, and things like that, and that I'm afraid that much of my perspective is that Mormons get tied up in the very practical realities of life, and I can deal with those Monday through Saturday. I want something different on Sunday, and I didn't find I was getting that.
I just want to say that I've enjoyed and I can relate to every one of you. I was married 18 years to a non-member, and it was real hard. Nobody would accept you. I lived in Utah. And nobody would accept, because I had a non-member husband. After 18 years, and the missionaries used to just drive us crazy. We had two old maids that lived across the street, and my husband worked two jobs, and the only night that he was home, those two ladies were there too, and told him he didn't live a full life because, you know, he didn't belong to the church. That, to make a long story short, he joined the church. He's been a Mormon bishop. In fact, he's been very active the last 25 years as a Mormon, and I've kind of gone against it. But I want you to know this has been the most marvelous time of my life, because I go to school. I'm a full-time student up here at the university, but because he is so involved with his being a bishop, and he is a wonderful bishop. People just love him. Oh, he's just wonderful. But we've only been married 49 years. But anyway, I just wanted to say what a wonderful session this was. And I could just feel every one of you, you talked, you gave, you know, part of my life as I've gone through these things. Thank you.
Anybody else?
I think some of us, as Mormons, have become so sensitive about pushing our religion and forcing it on people outside it. And I think that it's a serious concern that we need to worry about, and that is being overbearing, coming forth. But I felt myself becoming rather apologetic about my religion as a result. And I think I would like to know just some personal responses on how I can represent myself as a Latter-day Saint who has gone through some, you know, relatively excruciating crises of faith, some of those things. I would like to be able to be open and honest and contributive in my conversations with people outside of my faith without being pushy or demanding or without forcing things on, without even being perceived as such. I really don't know how to do that at times. I think that I'm so apologetic about talking about my religion and forcing it on people that I can't make it an honest part of my representation of self and my own being able to contribute my perspective to a conversation or to a feeling. Do you have any suggestions for that, either for yourselves or for the people that you've spoken to outside of the Mormon community?
I used to speak of this at the university frequently because I think in talking about religion to another person, there are always two levels of conversation going on. First is what's kind of socially acceptable or theologically appropriate, describing these concepts. The other level is very psychological and personal, and that you need to be aware that both are taking place. And what bothers me is that when the personal or the psychological level begins to violate what's a social level, it's time to stop talking. I remember there was a conference at Westminster College, I think the only one that I've ever experienced here in Utah in the 10 years I've been here, where Catholics, Protestants, and LDS came together to talk honestly and straightforwardly with each other, that there was a man from BYU who at lunch said, "You know, I don't even talk about my faith to someone unless I have a relationship with them to the point that I know that we love each other." And it's in that context that we talk about our faith.
All right, that's our 10 minutes, I think. So if we close now, and then if you want to address individual questions, I'm sure they'd be happy to speak with you.